San Juan, my old San Juan, a nostalgic song about the capital city of Puerto Rico, widely regarded as an unofficial anthem to the island, a yearning for the days that were, when Puerto Rico was a cherished colony by its citizens. But a lot has happened since then. And more specifically, we are talking about the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. 9 months after Hurricane Maria ripped through and ripped apart Puerto Rico with its forceful winds and torrential rain that knocked out the island's power grid and wiped out much of its infrastructure and its crops, the island still continues to struggle monumentally with impediments to recovery. In our first status report, citizen status report, we're not depending on news organizations in this case, we're talking directly to the people so that they can tell us directly what is going on. We heard from Elisa Lienza, L-L-E-N-Z-A, a Puerto Rican citizen journalist and activist, and she provided an account of what was going on in this effort to recover the massive impediments that are in the way of actually recovering. She talked about the demand on the government to approach this process sanely. That hasn't happened. The way the United States government has treated this island and the people of its island, which is disgraceful, nothing short of it. But in the meantime, the people suffer. And so this is life. Life is about finding a way to survive. You may recall some time ago, I say years ago, when we started covering the forced bankruptcy of the city of Detroit. I did say that the reason we had to pay attention to the process in the city of Detroit is that it will serve as a template for how vast areas across the United States and of course, with Puerto Rico, a possession, quote-unquote, of the United States, we will see similar moves being made to depopulate vast areas, to repopulate it with people who are more, quote, desirable, unquote. And Puerto Rico came up on that list. He said, watch it. Watch Detroit. Study Detroit, because it is setting the example for how this is going to be done. It is, Detroit was the science, the development of the science of mass depopulation. And so with the Hurricane Maria, Hurricane Maria provided a fantastic opportunity to go back to the template, to refine it, and to bring about something the U.S. government had been planning for a very long time, which is, again, to depopulate the island. And now you had the destruction, all that infrastructure destroyed, all these people displaced. You had all this misery, people unable to even just traverse one street to another. It was the perfect storm in that sense, because it gave the planners at all these different levels a golden opportunity to revisit and to revise and to update their plan. So Elisa joins us again today to provide on-the-ground reports on how the island is trying to weather the social, political, and economic storms that now beset the island. Elisa, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, Eustace, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to share anything I can give the people that are our listeners so that they have a better idea of what's going on. And also, we need help. So anybody that's willing to give us a hand and make more awareness of what we're going through is welcome.
Thank you. All right. So in the interim, between the time we last talked and today, there's been a big squabble over exactly how many deaths did Hurricane Maria cause. Could you tell us why that is an important question?
Well, it is an important question, first of all, because any government has to manage under an emergency like this the life of its citizens and avoid the death to begin with. So first of all, in order for us to know what happened and how to avoid it, what wasn't done so that it doesn't happen again, you have to know what happened. And there has been no formal accounting done correctly by the government. And this has been going on since the beginning. I mean, when President Trump came to Puerto Rico, he was there, as you mentioned, the government was like behind in the way it was addressing the issue. It seemed to be that there was nothing really bad going on and that most people had survived. And when he was sitting with the governor only had 16 deaths to be accounted for. And he and the president automatically said, well, this isn't really that bad then, because Katrina was the real, like a real emergency where thousands of lives were lost. And so from that very day, we've had an issue with that, because I don't know if it's because of the, you know, naive nature of certain people in the government, or they really wanted to seem to be doing the correct thing, or they were in denial, or they were totally ignorant of what was going on. But they didn't want to make it seem like we had an unmanageable situation going on. That's my take on it, because they were in total denial. Even that day after President Trump left, there were reported 60-some deaths just after he left. So, you know, we did know that there was something going on. And what you heard from people that you could have a chance to talk to, because, mind you, everybody here had no electricity, so they had no television. Most people had no radio because people depend on the cell phones nowadays to listen to radio. So there's not that many folks around with the old-style radios to listen. So nobody really knew what was going on. I think people in the United States and in the world knew more because the broadcasting news that came here to cover the event were transmitting abroad, and they had their own power plants, and people were seeing the disaster that we had really no idea what was going on. People weren't even able to leave their neighborhoods many times because the trees were in the way. So it was a whole lack of communication going on, and there was nothing set up for even the local municipal governments to communicate with the central government. And it, so the deaths were not reported correctly either. I mean, even the government agency that deals with forensics was uncommunicated for a long time. They all depended on cell phones, and the whole system came down. The government did not have a communication option after the hurricane for several weeks. As far as I can tell you that it was terrible. And even after we were questioning this, and I worked as a volunteer at one of the radio stations, the only one that was left broadcasting, people would come and tell us, and we were trying to let the government know what we have been reported by these people, and nothing was really been taken care of. So what happened is CNN and local Instituto de Centro Periodístico de Investigaciones, is a local investigative reporting group, they started demanding information because the government was not giving out official information, and they had the number totally only 64 people. And for a few months there, they would not give it. And so they took the government to court. This is something that just happened last week. And although we do not have all the information, they handed over 24,000 files of death certificates in September. And they're looking at it right now at this moment, Utris, but just to let people know, I can't give you any final information yet because they're still looking at the cases. They have just started on a one-by-one basis. But they have already found many cases.
What occurred to me with this whole thing is, why was it necessary? Why couldn't or why didn't they rely on resources that were right there all the time? You have the university at Puerto Rico. You have people who know how to count. Why was it necessary to wait until CNN decided, and I'm not razzing them, I'm glad that they took the initiative on this project, but
there's so many suspicions about why it could have happened. Let's put it this way. I do want to mention that at the end there, under pressure, the government finally decided to give a contract to George Washington University. It's a $1,500,000 contract so that they will pick up the information and make a report. Now, as you say, Puerto Rico has all the institutions and all the professionals that are needed and that work with this type of thing on a daily basis for forever, you know, like the Forensic Institute, which deals with all kinds of diagnosis that related to death. I mean, unless it's one of the ways that you don't have to have an autopsy, all the autopsies go through that office, and they're the official institution that determines death. Well, they're available. And after we started the fiscal crisis on the island and the budget for the University of Puerto Rico was substantially reduced, the governor promised that any kind of contract that he would be able to give from the government to have work done, he would give to the University of Puerto Rico so that some income would come in and they would not have the crisis that they have right now with the budget. Well, we have a medical school at the university and a very prestigious one. It's a university. Even during the AIDS era, we were one of the major investigative institutions for AIDS because we do have great professionals. They have a public health school that could be have been in charge of this and used all the other institutions involved, like the forensic medicine, like the demographics office that we have that takes statistics. We have a statistics institute that runs and collects information from the country, and it's an independent organization, which they're trying to close down because they don't want to have this come out. I mean, all kind of information is being restricted right now. We have a funeral association. We have a hospital association. We have associations of mayors that were the first line to help people. I mean, people had people die in their homes, and funeral homes would not take the bodies because they didn't have electricity. The municipal government had no option. They ended up putting large containers at the Forensic Institute because they didn't have enough space to take care of all the bodies. Hospitals had more bodies than they could take care of, and no electricity in many cases for the air conditioners. So
the main point I'm trying to drive at is every time we have a disaster like this, the information, which is now a product, it never, ever ends up in the hands of the local people. It never does. And we don't know what the arrangement is as to why. How is it that a university outside of Puerto Rico, which has, as you just said, a reputable medical and university, medical college, and has been, in fact, in the forefront of many studies having to do with tropical diseases and so forth. How did this happen that this contract was won outside of Puerto Rico? And the information outside of Puerto Rico.
There wasn't even a bid for this. This was just, they were selected. And after a few some time passed by, it was publicly spoken about. Governor Ricardo Rosello's father, who is a doctor and was governor between, I think it was 2013 to, I mean, 1999 to 2000. He was the governor, Pedro Rosello, the doctor Pedro Rosello. After he left the governorship, he went as a faculty member to George Washington University. And the press here has tied the university and the fact that the new governor, who is his son, has given the contract to this university. They have tied the fact that the father was part of the university. So it's like a handout of some kind to somebody that's related in government. Because as you say, we had everything here. And the worst part about something like this, Dietrich, is that they cannot do this without knocking the doors of all the institutions I just talked with you about. They don't have the information, and the information is not posted publicly anywhere. So they have to knock on the doors of the University of Puerto Rico. They have to knock on the doors of the forensic institution, a statistics institution, demographic institution, and all the hospitals in there. And it's going to be a very long process because they're doing it from outside and more expensive. I mean, this is why we have these agencies set up in the government, and they're not being used properly. And the money is also being reduced in the budget now. So that's also creating additional hardship for us because we can't manage government if we don't have enough people to do the job. And this money is not properly.
Let's take a look at the budget process. But before we do that, so far, what is the figure? It's more than 4,000 people. And
yes, because
now they're trying to figure out more precise ways in which to categorize the deaths, whether they were directly caused by Hurricane Maria, whether they were indirectly caused, or what the actual cause of death was, and to categorize that. Why is that process important, apart from the fact that it is important to know, you know, how many people died, how they died, and so forth? But is there something else significant about wanting to be specific about how people died?
Okay, the number, by the way, is a calculation that was made by a study that was done by Harvard University with 3,500 people in a sample. It was like a survey done. They didn't actually go into the books, and they calculated from doing interviews and some preliminary information that they got that that would be the minimum number of deaths. The reason why it's an issue is because a lot of people died after the hurricane because they were not taken care of because of what most people consider neglect from the government. Not having water, not having electricity, not having a hospital to go to. We have a very, very high population of diabetic people that need to have their insulin refrigerated. And if they don't have their insulin, they have complications. We have a large population of dialysis patients. They couldn't even get to the centers. And when they got there, there was no services being held there and no information on where they could go. So people deteriorated their health. And a lot of there's reports of people that were buried in their backyard because they were in the cars for a few days and nobody knew what to do. And so it's very, very disturbing. It's not supposed to be happening in a country that we were living in a country of progress where there was social or government order to take care of these things. And so that's one of the issues that is very annoying. And the fact that there are still people, Utris, that are living in dire conditions with no electricity 9 months after those two hurricanes hit, and we're already in hurricane season, and people are very nervous about that this can happen again. It's like genocide by default or on purpose is what a lot of people are beginning to feel, that this is an attack on the people. And it has to stop. And the only way you can really stop it is if you have the information.
This is the lesson. And people should not dismiss it. When these kinds of disasters strike, or any disaster, you would see a mad scramble by various institutions to own the information. So that if, say, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, a Puerto Rican person wants to just get for him or herself an independent, put together an independent analysis, that information is now proprietary information. And it mm-hmm. won't be available to the public for some time. In what ways would it be used? We don't know. But immediately I said, well, wait a minute. Puerto Rico has all these resources. If the idea is to put together a profile of deaths and causes of death and so forth, it could do that. There's no reason that Harvard University has to own that information or that George Washington University has to own that information. But these are the ways in which tragedy actually provides a great deal of money to institutions. And you would never think that, but that's what happens. Suddenly they come in and from the outside because they have connections. And contracts are drawn up. Not because, well, they deserve it, but because there are connections that allow people to bypass what would seem to be a fair process. Why can't Puerto Ricans participate? And they qualify to do it. And they have institutions that could do it. But in both cases, they were bypassed. Now, let's talk about the budget. The last time we talked, Governor Rosselló was putting together his budget, and there's been a big deal about this budget. Could you give us a fast overview of the budget and what the issues are from the people's point of view?
Yes. As most people might know, we do have an economic crisis in Puerto Rico that has been going on for some time, and more than 2 years ago, it became so unbearable and Puerto Rico was going to default on its payments. These are municipal bonds and other forms of loans that the government, it's the way the system works in the United States where people, the government takes money in advance as, you know, borrows money to administer itself or to do different types of projects, and then you have to pay back. So this whole thing became very unmanageable, and Congress decided to create what they call the Puerto Rico Oversight Management and Economic Stability Act, which the letters compose the word promesa, which means promise in Spanish. And this was law creates what they call the Financial Oversight and Management Board for Puerto Rico, which we call La Junta. This happened because Puerto Rico could not go to bankruptcy court after the 80s. We were taken out of the law, and so we could no longer manage things like this in a bankruptcy court. So this created something similar to a bankruptcy court so that we could manage the debt. Well, budgets come up now, and we have to have a financial budget for 2019. Before the end of this month, although the government of Puerto Rico is supposed to sit down before they actually present the budget and kind of agree on what the budget is going to be like. Every time they present the budget, there's opposition because of the budget cuts that are going on, and most of the government agencies have already received budget cuts for the last 5 years. So it's become such a problem now, Utrecht, that many of the agency directors say that they're not going to be functional if they have more money reduced from their budget. Now, it's also the big issue now, besides the budget itself and all the cuts that are going on, is that all of a sudden the board has insisted that we have Law 80, which was passed, I think it was in the end of the 70s, which is a law that protects workers in the private sector from abusive employers. And things like if you were working after a certain amount of years and they decide to let you go, they have to compensate you according to how many years you've worked. You get a severance pay for a weekly severance pay. And you have other protections by law. It also protects the employer because the employer cannot be sued separately if he complies and compensates the employee that he's letting go. But the Promesa law was supposed to be only for public budget and government spending and not anything with the private sector. And they want to eliminate all protection laws for the government. And the government of Puerto Rico is being threatened by the board that if they do not eliminate this law, which protects rights in the private sector, they will reduce other things and eliminate other things that people want to keep, including the vacations. They want to reduce the 2 week vacations a year. They have a small Christmas bonus for public employees. And even some in the private sector, if the company has a certain amount of income, they have to compensate the employees. And they're threatening to reduce a whole series of things and attack the pension funds and other things if they do not have this law eliminated. So this has become a big discussion because people were keeping quiet, the people in the private sector, thinking that the government was too much expense. And they thought that it was only going to be the government that was going to be, controlled by this law. But now it's become a big thing here because the Promesa law also allows the government to reduce the minimum wage for people under 25 to $4.25 an hour. Well, we already have many workers fleeing the island, especially people that can get a good job. A lot of the people before the hurricane that had already left were leaving because they got good jobs. And, you know, a young couple with children and with all the cuts in the public school system here, they couldn't afford to have their kids in private schools here. And they've been going to the mainland where public schools are, in many states, are really good. So, and they get good jobs and they can, you know, progress in at a young age when they have children to raise. And so doing this $4.25 an hour for people under 25, it's not attractive to have workers stay here, which goes takes us back to that thing that you've been mentioning about depopulating the island. They don't say that's what they want to do, but it's obvious that they're doing it. And how are, where is there going to have any money coming in on the island to pay the debt if you keep on having the people that produce income are going to continue to leave, and they want to leave people with the minimum wage, be it $7.25 or $4.25, that still doesn't produce money for a country to develop, you know, an economy where they can pay any debt. So this is really critical. And then the latest reduction in the budget, just so you have an idea, they want to reduce the controller's office. The controller is the agency that revises all contracts, the legality of contracts between the government and private companies. They want to reduce another 24% the budget. That would make them not able to control all the budget, all the investigation that they need to do on contracts. So you'll have more fraud. And the other office is the ethics office, which foresees that there not be corruption in government. And those two agencies are being drastically cut in their budgets. We have the education budget is drastically cut. We have the health budget at the municipal level they have eliminated in the budget the money that was given to clinics in the municipal level. So they have given a certain amount of money for the government medical plan that not everybody can access. It's a small amount of more money than they had from last year. But then they left in zero what they call the CDTs, which is a municipal health clinic. So people in the mountains will no longer have a small office with a doctor and a nurse to take care of the small things before they decide to take them to a larger hospital. And between the situation that we have with the roads and lack of public transportation in the small towns and everything, it's going to be very difficult for people to have health services. And the roads are a disaster. I mean, and the budgets are going down in all the departments. It's becoming very, very difficult. Then the board has raised their budget for their cost to deal with the bankruptcy court. And they've also raised themselves another $750,000 additional to the $60 million that they already have from the budget for themselves to manage this board. And the money comes out of Puerto Rico's budget. So when you have these people living the way they're living with all kinds of escorts and translators and security people, and they eat where they're meeting at hotels, and when they travel, you know, it's a very expensive proposition, and we don't have the money for that. So this is becoming terrible for the people on the island. We don't even have this debt audited, by the way. They have refused to audit the debt to see if we really owe these $73 billion that we're being charged, which is another bad issue, a big issue for us here. They were supposed to audit it, and part of their responsibility is to evaluate the debt. And they did contract somebody, a company, to do this, but the thing is that they're not going to specify what really happened and who's responsible for it. So they just are going to audit it to see what went wrong so it doesn't happen again. But, you know, we want to know how we got into this position. And we had the past government had actually passed a law where they created a committee for the auditing of the debt. And they assigned the $2 million and had several professional economists on this committee that were evaluating the debt, and the preliminary evaluation found that some of the debt, a large amount of it, could be up to 72% interest rate, which is not legal. And we have things like refinancing interest over and over and over again. And we were also loaned more money when they knew we could not pay it back, which is not supposed to happen in the banking industry either. So, and none of this is being audited. When the new government came in, they canceled the law and eliminated the commission. So there's a private group of citizens that have organized, and they are fundraising now to continue the auditing with private funds from the citizens. And there is big hope that if we are given the information to these people that are going to do this, that we will find out who put us in this situation. And if illegal things have been done, then that money will be eliminated from the debt.
Because so I right want to ask this question. Because, okay, there's nobody on the planet who doubts that Puerto Rico suffered tremendous damage as a result of the hurricane. Nobody doubts that. Nobody doubts that in the aftermath, Puerto Ricans are going to be living in extreme circumstances. Nothing would be the same. FEMA and the emergency funds that are supposed to kick in at the federal level, whatever happened to that? Donald Trump showed up and he throws paper towels at people and that kind of thing. And it was as if, well, Puerto Rico, you know, these are tough people. They'll get through. What happened to this, the responsibility, if I could put it this way, of the federal government to at least make an exception for Puerto Rico in light of the devastation, the utter devastation that it experienced? You're talking about a budget that even after Hurricane Maria is calling for cuts.
Even more than last year.
To an already devastated island. So where is the money that the federal government was supposed to put into the pot to get the country at least stable? What happened to that?
Well, there's a whole bunch of programs that they announce, and you call in and you ask for help, and there have been many issues for people to even get the help through the phones. I mean, you had to do it online or through the phones, and people didn't have phones or internet, so that just delayed the whole process. Then there has been money that has been assigned to Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, but it hasn't been disbursed in Puerto Rico because the government, the federal government, has issues with the information the local government is giving. I can tell you that I'm not making anybody more or less responsible, but usually what happens in an emergency is that FEMA comes in, but they depend on the local government to coordinate and to give them the preliminary information on what's going on. And then they're the experts that are supposed to manage the initial things and help funnel the monies to come in and repair. Well, if the local government doesn't know what's going on, or they're in shock because this had never happened, and it's a new administration with very young people that, you know, were probably children when we had our last big hurricane. So they have no memory of how to manage smaller emergencies in this case. So the whole thing has built up. And then, for example, we just had in January, they started a new program that's called Tu Hogar Renace, with federal funds administered through the housing department, the local housing department. And the contract was questioned in court because the company didn't have the requirements for the bid, but they're still managing the program. And since most of the local companies here don't have the amount of money that they need to be to guarantee that they can participate in it, well, many of the companies are from the United States. There are a few local ones, and one of them has some kind of an alliance with one of the United States companies. These are companies that have worked since Katrina, and there are issues with some of the people that might have had problems managing funds in the past. This has all been coming out in the press. And then people are having their homes evaluated, and they just don't come in and fix them, or they don't fix them correctly. Right now, there's a whole big investigation. They have over 7,000 complaints about things that have not done been done correctly. And the most terrible part of all this is it's already hurricane season again, and FEMA is not substituting the tarps for wooden roofs where the homes lost part of the roof or the whole roof. So these people are not safe in another emergency. And the money has been spent. Some of it is still on hold because the way FEMA works is they assign the money, but the municipal governments, for example, that picked up the debris and all the trees and the trash and everything, they had to comply with certain rulings. And so the rulings didn't come in. You know, there's a whole, like, a work manual that you have to comply with if you want to have the money reimbursed for your expenses. So if you don't know what the rules are and you don't document things correctly, the municipal government will not get the money that they spent on the emergency. So that was delayed, too. And now with the construction, it's the same thing. So the money's not really being used as fast as it should. You know, we don't really know what's holded because the local government says one thing and FEMA it reports another thing, and the people are stuck in the middle of this. And Utrecht, it's creating it's an emotional situation here. People are very demoralized, unstable, in shock. Some people don't even call FEMA anymore. They had to extend several times the deadlines for you to apply for these programs because people just weren't calling in because they already had a bad experience with the first phase, and most of the people were rejected when they asked for help. And a lot of them are being referred to Small Business Administration for loans. Well, people don't have jobs. You don't have credit to qualify for a loan to fix your house. And then
dare I ask you, what is the state of affairs with reconstruction of homes and repairs of homes by HUD?
Right now, they're entering a new phase. There's CBDS funds that are coming in, and a lot of it is for municipal structures to be fixed, and they're going to renovate some of the things that were only emergency repairs were done in the past. And they're already talking of constructing more homes, which is ridiculous because there are reports that we have over 250,000 housing units that are empty right now. And this is one of the things that is a problem for us in Puerto Rico. They always evaluate economic progress with how much cement is sold on the island. So they keep on making more construction, and usually it is not for the type of people that live on the island. They keep on making homes that are not affordable for people. There's a lot of housing shortage right now for people that rent, and FEMA does not fix homes or hasn't fixed until now any of the homes that were rented that have been destroyed. So people that lost the place they lived because they rented are having a real hard time to find another place to live. And this is another issue that is not being handled correctly because we've had the speculators come in to buy cheap real estate, and they're fixing the homes for Airbnb rentals. Even though they're close to the beach and they used to be poor neighborhoods where normal people lived, now they want to fix these properties for Airbnb and other companies that do the same type of rental. So we're losing the availability of low-income residential rentals. And, it's becoming a problem. And they're also, you know, they're trying to get rid of public housing. We are under the U.S. Public Housing Department, and you know what they're trying to do in the United States. We do have people here that pay rent in the public housing systems, and they pay a flat maximum amount of water bills and electricity, but they do pay. It's not like everybody that lives in these housing projects are not working and live off the government. I've seen people at 4 o'clock in the morning coming out of their residential projects to go to work with their lunch box. You know, it's not what people think. And so if the budgets are going down and they're trying to make it more difficult to continue having people, where are people going to live? I mean, it's a very, very serious thing that's going on, and there's no coordination. As far as I'm concerned, the major problem is that people that are making decisions have no, in many cases, have no understanding of what the real needs are. So the solutions are not going to be adequate for the people. And there's no, there's, we don't even have a new plan set up. They're just starting to talk about what the communities have to prepare for and how to organize themselves for the next emergency, which has been announced, by the way. We're supposed to have another very strong hurricane season. And every time something comes up in the news, you can imagine how people start feeling about this. They don't feel secure. They don't feel that the government's ready to take care of another emergency.
So when you add up these indications, for you, I mean, you're a seasoned reporter, you've gotten around the island, you know what's happening. You add up these things. What is the picture that you come up with?
Well, I can tell you positive things because I would like people to know that it's not like everybody's just sitting here depressed. There are people that have survived, and many communities took charge of themselves if they had the means to do it, or like in the agriculture sectors on the island, people that had machinery did the cleaning of the roads, and the lines were cleared out by themselves until they ran out of diesel at the beginning of the emergency. And they have continued, and we have a young people that are in agriculture that are insisting on having a food supply here of local things so that we don't go through this other situation. There are people that were actually didn't have water or food for days because we depend 85% on importing food from the United States. So even though the government is eliminating the agriculture department budget, they're reducing it to ridiculous amounts. There's a local effort going on for people that are trying to organize. It's very difficult when you don't have the money. And sometimes you're not allowed to do things from the government, but they are doing it. I think that several groups are being formed, and as I told you, the Citizens Front for the auditing of the debt is moving ahead, and there's also groups with the diaspora, because many Puerto Rican people in the United States wanted to come and help, and they didn't even have the opportunity because there were no airline flights. But they have been working, and they want to help us, and they want to help us protect us from these bad decisions that are going on. As far as I'm concerned, we should try to insist that we be given an opportunity like for a few years. We can't have as a priority paying the debt when people are trying to survive. There's no way this place is going to ever be able to pay a debt if they continue to take us down the road they're trying to take us down. And, I can't imagine that even though there might be a lot of people that might want to come live here, what are they going to come to if the social structure here is not in shape? I mean, there's only so many rich people that will want to come here and have their home here so they can have a tax break that is issued here on the island. But, most stable countries don't have only rich people. You know what I mean? So we need to have more equality. Puerto Rico happens to be one of the places where there's a most drastic difference between in wealth between the people that have and the people that don't have. And that was not that way for a long time. We had a middle class that has been deteriorating and losing its wealth because of all these things that have been going on. So I just think that, we really need to start doing something urgent and have the people in the United States, the Congress, which has decided on this fiscal board, if they really want to, do good, they're change a little bit because the proposals are not correct for the situation. And this is an emergency situation, and it's not going to change for several years.
Well, I do know this. Despite all the misery and inconvenience, and loss. There are people who are very, very happy with the situation because now they get almost to start their plan with a new slate, a clean slate. They can start from scratch. They don't have to bulldoze the buildings. The buildings are practically bulldozed themselves. So they'll come in and they will do, again, just as it was done in Detroit and is being done still in Detroit. They will systematically push people to the point where they decide to leave the country. And in leaving the country, they will leave their land. And that's what the mad scramble ultimately is about. The Hurricane Maria was a godsend in that sense because it cleared, literally, it cleared the path. So we will
and
see.
Go
ahead.
No, I was going to say that Puerto Rico, you know, there are damaged properties, but some of the best properties that are not being used right now don't really have big problems to it. Like, you know, there are a lot of government structures, and besides, the most important thing that Puerto Rico has is its natural resources and the beaches and you know, the mountain ranges which are there. So they have that to take care of it, to pick up, you know, like if you have 250,000 homes that are not being used right now and you get them for pennies and all they need is to have a little painting and a few other things to, and it's there because the banks are, they take them away from the people, but then they sell them for nothing. So it's not like there are places where they will destroy everything, but it's like Detroit where I was in 2 weeks ago. There are beautiful buildings that are empty, you know, brick buildings that don't have any problems with them. They're just empty. They're, you know, they're not producing. And this is, we seem to be in the scope of this plan that you have seen in many parts of the world where they're trying to take over the goods and take the poor people after people have lived in bad conditions for many years. Want to take those people that sacrificed so many years on, you know, with limited resources, structures, you know, limited electricity, limited roads, like in Lois Aldea and other places in the countryside. And now they want those properties for beach resorts and things like that, and they want these people to be taken out. So it's really, you know, it's an affair that really has to do with human rights, I feel myself.
I think you're right about that. Well, Elisa, we've come to the end of our program today. I want to thank you for the copious amount of information that you have and that you've been sharing. I'm hoping that people listening to you would understand that this isn't just a report about how people are trying to recoup after a massive storm, but it is also how sinister forces are already at work, accomplishing many things that we don't see in a process that does not have the goodwill of the people at heart, but that is on course to take Puerto Rico, take the land, as they said in Detroit, to reimagine Puerto Rico. This is the time that they would do it. I talked to the audience before. Twice I went almost crazy on the air when a federal court was having a hearing in San Juan, and you had real estate interests, Wall Street interests, banking interests, all kinds of business interests, and not one single representative for the people. And they were deciding what was going to happen. A month later, in New York, in federal court in New York, a similar meeting. Wall Street interests, banking interests, business interests, all meeting to decide how to carve up this island of Puerto Rico. So we know that there's a double agenda here, and we'll get to expose that very shortly when next we talk to you. But for today, you've handled quite a bit and given us a better understanding of what's going on.
Well, I really appreciate it, and yes, I'm here. And thank you so much for your personal interest in us. I really appreciate that, and I'm sure that people in Puerto Rico are very grateful for you and some of the other people that have decided that they want to let this information out. And I'd be more than willing to make some more research and get some more professional people that are specialized in economics and other health issues, for example, in education, so we can get into more of this, with more information. I wanted to give everybody a general picture so that they can start understanding better, but I'm more than willing and grateful for you to have us on the air in the future.
Oh, no question about it. And this is the best kind of education. I say it all the time, peer-to-peer education. We don't have to wait for the professors and whatnot. We have people like you who know exactly what's going on the ground and who can relay the information to us and educate us about what's going on. So thank you once again, Elisa. And we look forward to seeing you soon on the air, filing your third status report.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Saludos.
Okay. That brings us to the end of our program today. I really had wanted us to be able to have space for your questions, but it's okay. We'll get to that. The main thing is to get the information. And you would notice that not much of what she has said has appeared any place else, because they're not looking at that. But we know intuitively that there's another program about to surface, and we'll keep track of it. Thank you for joining me today. Stay tuned. Coming up next, what the hell is going on? Bye-bye.